know it's gonna be a lovely day. Instead of me, always seems to know the way. Then I look at you, and the world's alright with me. I just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What's this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It sounds very hipster.
That's the worst thing.
Look at how humanity has used their intellect.
Self-help radio, a different theme explored with music and talk every week. Tuesdays, midnight to 3 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I don't know where to begin. We have a situation in Iran that is layered and very complex. We have a situation in Cuba. We have a situation that many people have forgotten about that's going on in Venezuela. We still have stuff going on in Gaza and the occupied territories. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. We won't even begin to talk about the incursions that many people are dealing with ICE. And it just seems to be very chaotic, intentionally so, designed to keep people off balance, not knowing which way to look, which way to turn. But here we're going to try our best to make sense of things. I couldn't think of a better person to bring on than Medea Benjamin, primarily. Most of you know her for her work with Code Pink, but she's an author. She's been talking about war. She's been talking about foreign policies, and we know her and love her for the work that she does because she consistently goes to Washington, D.C. and confronts lawmakers directly. I don't know how many times you've been arrested or escorted out of buildings, but it's not easy work, and we're glad that we have you here today. So I guess the obvious question to start with, Medea, is looking at Iran and how do we make sense of it? On one hand, we heard that there were tens of thousands of people killed who were protesting this current regime. And I don't think there's too many people that look favorably on him. And of course, with him being killed, there were a lot of people cheering. But how can you cheer with a country that is doing its own genocide? You know, so that's where we get the complications and layers. But how have you made sense of this, and what should we really be looking at when we talk about Iran?
Well, first, let's look at the history of U.S. intervention. Nothing good comes of it. No democracy comes of it. For the Iranian people that have been trying so hard to make their country more democratic, this is not going to help them. Look at the way Trump is trampling on what we have left of our democracy here at home. And if you think Israel is interested in democracy in Iran, look at what they are doing in Palestine. So if this is something that the U.S. and Israel are involved in, you can bet it's not going to help the Iranian people. In fact, I think that what Israel is really interested in is chaos in Iran, is breaking up Iran, and is creating what is actually starting to happen right now, a renewed round of infighting between Shia Muslims in Iran and in the Shia, other parts of the what's called the Shia Crescent, and the Sunni Muslims in the Arab world. This is in the interest of Israel, but it's not in the interest of any of the Muslims or of us, because we already see energy prices rising as a result of Iran cutting off the Strait of Hormuz and attacking energy facilities in the Gulf states. So this is just, Davey, it's spinning out of control.
Where do you see it headed at the end of the day? And also, who is the main, I guess, protagonist in this situation? Is it the U.S. or is it Israel leading the charge?
Well, it's a good question, and different people will give you different answers. I feel that it's Israel leading the charge, and has convinced Donald Trump that this is a perfect time to get rid of a regime that the U.S. has wanted to get rid of now for many decades. And it's interesting that the U.S. puts the date in 1979 with the Islamic Revolution instead of putting the date in 1953 when the U.S. overthrew the democratically elected government in Iran. Iran would be a very different country today if that secular government had not been overthrown. In any case, I think it is Israel has its own maniacal interests in keeping this war going and destroying as much of Iran as it can. I think the U.S., you know, Donald Trump does not want to have a long war that he knows is not popular. The public opinion polls have been so clear. The American people do not want this. I think it was 20% or 21% that said they supported attacks on Iran. And as this keeps going, you know, it's always like this. When U.S. service people start getting killed, there are some people who say, oh, we better support the government. But as it goes on, more and more people will say, wait a minute, this is not really what I voted for. It's interesting. I put out a tweet the other day asking MAGA people if this was what they voted for. And it's such an interesting conversation, Davey, with so many of them saying, absolutely not. This is not what we wanted. So Trump, you know, is sensitive to that base, and I don't think he's going to want this to go on and on. He has to have an off-ramp, a way to say, oh, we killed Khamenei, we killed the great leader, you know, now Iran is decapitated and is ready to talk. But Israel is going to say, no, keep this war going.
I mentioned that we've heard these stories about the brutal regime and thousands of people being killed who are protesting in the streets. And there's a few layers and levels to that. One, we know that the U.S. has stoked opposition in many countries. Venezuela, we know that happened. We saw that happen with Libya, right? And anytime you see oppressed people, you want them to be relieved of that oppression. When we started to hear the numbers, few hundred, then it was a few thousand, then there were estimates going up at like 36,000 people were killed by this regime. One but can't help to be like, damn, if we get rid of the person who did that, why wouldn't I be cheering in the streets? Why wouldn't there be folks feeling relief from that. At the same time, we have the realities that you just explained about the history of the two countries involved. How do we kind of parse that out for somebody who has lost loved ones, who has been under this dictatorship and this brutal regime for the past few decades, who want immediate relief?
You know, I've been to Iran several times. I've been to so many countries that are under U.S. sanctions, and I know that sanctions strengthen repressive governments. It makes it harder for people to change the government because they rely on the government for getting around these sanctions. And when you see in Iran that the government controls so much of the economy, or the more of the Revolutionary Guards and the Islamists, they control so much of the economy, that's because of the sanctions. And so if you lifted the sanctions, if you stopped provoking, if you stopped Israel from provoking, I think the Iranian people would have an easier time. In fact, this president, Pezeshkian, was elected on a reform platform. And I think he is somebody who would have wanted to make more reforms in Iran if he had not been pushed against the wall as he's being pushed now. And he's lucky that for right now he's still alive. But what the U.S. does is make it harder and harder for Iranian people to make their government more democratic.
Let me come to the current situation. So we get rid of Khamenei. We get rid of him. People are cheering. What comes next? Is because, you know, the bustering of the U.S., especially through Trump, is that now everything is good, you all are free, we're going to control it, and Iranian people, you know, happy days are here. How do you see this playing out? Because that's what most Americans will take away from it. We did our job, we got rid of the people, let's be happy. What comes next?
The Iranian state has been described as a deep state, not in the terms that the U.S. uses it, but in the terms that these entities that control Iran go deep. And you can take out some of the heads, and then there'll be a new group of leaders that crop up. And oftentimes, as we know, those new group of leaders are usually more hardline than the last group was. Although we don't know in the case of whoever will be the new leadership, the Iranian people have to make their own changes, and we can't determine that. We talked already about both the history of the United States and Iran of overthrowing their government, the history of the United States in the region. It is our responsibility to stop our government from all of these interventions. You mentioned these other places. I just got back from Venezuela on my way to Cuba. I was there twice in the last 2 months. I mean, it's all over the world, Davey, and we have to realize the terrible role that our government plays in making people miserable around the world.
Real talk. And the reason I had you on, I was going to ask you about Venezuela. I saw that you were posting from there. So again, similar situation. People, there were a lot of people cheering, at least here in the States, you know, like, yes, he got rid of Maduro. He's been, you know, a dictator to us. I don't know how people on the ground feel about that. It seems like that might be a little bit different than maybe the black and white situation we see in Iran, but you were just there. So what is it? What's going on there? And we should remind people, this is probably the third or fourth time the U.S. has attempted regime change in Iran. I forget the filmmaker's name who did it, and it's in Juan Gonzalez's book as well.
Yeah, but I just want to comment when you said the black and white situation is in Iran. I think people ought to be aware that there are millions of people in Iran who hate their government, and there are millions of people in Iran who are devoted to their government. Mm. And we don't see the masses of people out on the street for the funeral of Khamenei. We don't see the masses of people around the Shia world just enraged at the death of who they call the great leader. So just remember, in Iran, as well as in Venezuela, as well as here in the United States, they are divided societies. So in Venezuela, a very divided society. And a similar situation to Iran in that U.S. sanctions have created so much hardship that it creates a lot of the opposition. And one thing I found particularly interested, Davey, is that the hardliners in the Democratic and Republican Party are saying to Trump, why didn't you take out that whole regime? Why did you just take out Maduro and his wife and leave the rest of the government in place? Well, there's very good reasons for that. One is the opposition in Venezuela is so divided that there's nobody to, quote, hand the government over to. And the other is that the government in Venezuela does have support. They do have people who believe in this government, who are very unhappy with the United States because of the sanctions that have led to the deaths of tens of thousands of people. So let's not be fooled by all the propaganda we hear. There are people on all sides of the issues in just about every country, and we have to look at why our government is propping up one side over the other. And in the case of Venezuela and the case of Iran, it's very clear. In Venezuela, we were told by people that Trump is not interested in democracy, human rights, elections. He's interested in three other things: oil, oil, and oil. And that is the case, and that's what we're seeing in the case of Venezuela. There, Delcy Rodriguez, who is the acting president, is moving ahead with her government in place, but with a gun to her head because Trump wants to make sure that the U.S. companies get that oil.
So let me ask you this. You mentioned earlier, Medea Benjamin, about the prices of oil going up as a result of what happened in Iran and the straits over there being closed. The simplistic thing that would be said by this administration is like, don't you worry about it because we got the oil from Venezuela, so your prices will go down, even though most people are looking and going, they went up. What's the reality of that? So U.S. companies take over this Venezuelan resource. Are we going to see that reflected?
The energy issue is so volatile. You know, one of the things that's happening with Iran right now is that it's China that is being really affected because a lot of the oil coming from Iran went to China. So some are saying that one of the interests of the United States in all of this is to hurt China. Yet on the other hand, as you implied, Davey, when Trump says that oil prices are, what, $1.99 a gallon at the gas station and people fill up their tanks and say, wait a minute, that wasn't what I paid. And the U.S. is supposedly self-sufficient in oil. Still, the U.S. wants to have more control over the oil market itself. And as these prices go up, there are some people who make a lot of money. The Saudis are already making more money with the prices going up, and there are oil producers in the U.S. that will make more money. But it is the consumers. And yes, the U.S. consumers will be hurt, and I think the European consumers, especially of the liquid natural gas that they're getting from the Gulf, will really be hit. And Europe has already been hit with the Russia-Ukraine war, not getting their energy from Russia. And so, you know, there are many U.S. allies that will be hurt with this war, and whether it's the manipulation of the oil from Venezuela or what is happening to the oil in the Middle East right now, many of the consumers are the ones who are going to pay the price.
Medea Benjamin is our guest. Now, connected to Venezuela is what we hear is happening in Cuba. So you've been there. I don't know if you've been there just recently to see the impact of the embargo that's been put on Venezuela, which impacts the Cuban government, which depends upon the oil there. We've heard the stories that people are being starved to death. I don't know if people can fully conceptualize what does that mean. And, you know, was the Venezuelan thing the initial end game, or was it just a byproduct, a two-for-one type of situation?
This is Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio wants to be seen as the person who overthrew what he calls the Castro regime, even though Castro has been dead for quite a while now. He wants to be seen as the one who did that. And he is using Venezuela as part of that strategy, stopping Venezuela from sending the oil, stopping Mexico from sending the oil. There just was 2 days ago a boat that was stopped coming from Russia sending oil. I was in Cuba twice in the last 2 months, and we are organizing a hemispheric show of solidarity and condemnation of what the U.S. is doing on March 21st. So I'd love a chance to talk about that. But to give you a sense of what's happening in Cuba, especially in the eastern part of the country where I was, there was only electricity about 2 to 6 hours a day. So just imagine if you didn't have electricity, Davey, we wouldn't be talking right now. If you didn't have gasoline to either get on a bus or get on a subway or get, of course, they don't have subways there, or to run your car if you had one. You don't have electricity, your refrigerator isn't working. You don't have electricity, the farmers can't get the food to the market. The hospitals have generators but have a hard time keeping them going, and the medicines are so scarce. The garbage is piling up in the street because there isn't gasoline to run the garbage trucks. And so there are more mosquito-borne diseases that people are getting, and then there isn't the medicine to treat them. So it is a vicious circle that is killing people. The infant mortality rate in Cuba used to be the pride of the Cuban people. It was better than in the United States because they took such good care of their people. And that is going up. That means more children are dying, more elder people are dying, more people with cancer who can't get the medicines are dying. It is really a brutal, brutal, demonic, sadistic policy that the U.S. is carrying out right now.
Cuba has been a part of and has been very instrumental in liberation movements all around the world, from South Africa on down. What's been the response? And you talked about a hemispheric response. I know Cuba's been demonized here, but in many places, as you pointed out, they are revered and loved and a model of how one can deal with the type of oppression that they face from this country, you know, with the sanctions and the whole nine. To your point that sanctions will breed a particular type of reaction, sometimes from the government. I think maybe they're calculating that if you put the sanctions on real hard, it's going to get opposition where people will want the U.S. and others to come in and play a heroic role. How do you see this ultimately playing out, especially with Cuba, you know, and the response? It seems like, you know, when you're doing this to Cuba, you're going to anger damn near everybody, at least in the Southern Hemisphere, you know, much less in various places around the world.
Well, you're bringing up two things, Davey. One is the opposition within Cuba, and certainly when people are living under such dire conditions, there are more and more people who say, wait, we just want this to end. We're ready to cry uncle. And then in terms of the hemisphere and the world, well, in the world community, we see it clearly every single year at the UN vote in the General Assembly, where the entire world, except for the US and Israel, condemn the blockade. And there is so much sympathy towards Cuba around the world, and especially in the hemisphere. Claudia Sheinbaum, the head of Mexico, has been pressured by Trump not to send oil, and many people in Cuba, in Mexico, are very upset with her about that. And so to ease that, she has been sending large shipments of humanitarian aid to Cuba, but of course that doesn't replace the fuel that they need. There are groups all over Latin America who are trying their best and they're sending humanitarian aid. And that's why we're organizing this big gathering in Cuba at this time of crisis. And there is still a little bit of room if people want to still go, Davey. We at Code Pink and other groups like Progressive International are taking a charter plane from Miami that leaves on March 20th. It'll be there from March 20th to March 23rd. And it will be the 21st is the day that we will all converge on the Malecón in Havana to be showing this tremendous opposition that we feel. And we hope that it will have some impact because the U.S. government is getting pressure from around the world saying, you can't starve people. This is not the right way to try to affect a change in government policy. And of course, they're also saying that the U.S. has absolutely no right to even interfere in the internal affairs of Cuba. So anybody who has the ability, please check out the Code Pink website, codepink.org, and you'll find more information about this historic gathering on March 21st.
And we'll definitely have you back on to, you know, reemphasize these efforts, Medea. As we close out, I'm thinking to myself, wow, with all the dependency on oil, when do we really go full throttle to commit ourselves to creating a new, you know, system, you know, where it's like, you know what, keep your oil. We have solar power. We got everything we need. So that's one question for us to, you know, I want to see you address. But the other one, which is a little bit more scary, is what sort of weapons are these incursions? What sort of weapons are being used, developed, you know, maybe being tested out with these incursions? We just saw the big fight with Anthropic and Claude and, you know, these AI things because for folks who don't know, one of the companies has a device that you can just kill indiscriminately and they refuse to give the codes to the Pentagon and allow them to use that. And they're like, okay, bet, you know, you're going to pay a price and we'll go to another company to develop that. So we have a country now that wants to have robotic soldiers. They want to be able to kill indiscriminately. And they have this type of weaponry that they are developing. And I can only think that they want to use Iran and Venezuela and any place that we are putting opposition on to as testing ground, maybe even here for all we know. So that's one. And so the other thing is, what are these places that are being attacked? Are they developing stuff? We're talking about nuclear weapons, but there's so many other things that the U.S. has been using, especially in the world of AI. That's where most of the, for folks who don't know, most of the AI stuff is not people on chat. It's with the Pentagon. That's 90% of the usage. That seems like something we should be definitely concerned about. But what are you seeing or hearing?
Well, let's go with the negative first and then go back to the solar panels, because mm-hmm. you're right, it is so scary. And of course, so many of these weapons were used on the people of Gaza. And it's Israel that has this huge weapons industry that is intertwined with the U.S. industry and with industries in other countries as well, where it brags in its marketing that these have been tested on the ground. And we see the results of that. The incineration of people. In fact, in Venezuela, when the January 3rd, the U.S. came in to kidnap Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores, there were over 100 people that were killed. And they told us, we can't find most of these bodies. These people were incinerated. We don't know what kind of weapons they were using. And the weapons that they're using now in Iran, I'm sure we're going to find out, are the most advanced weapons using the most advanced AI technology that there is. And let's remember, Davey, that we have now over $1 trillion that we're spending on war. $1 trillion. And Trump has just casually thrown out there, let's increase that by 50%, $1.5 trillion. We are destroying our country because we are spending so much money to find ever more lethal and high-tech ways to blow up the world. So yes, that's the scary part. And of course, in with that, that comes the ability to surveil every action of people around the world, including here at home. On the positive side, in the 1990s, when the Soviet Union fell apart, Cuba was left in dire straits. About 60% of its revenue was cut, like from one day to the next. And they didn't have the chemical fertilizers or chemical inputs to use in their agriculture, and they had to go cold turkey into organic agriculture. I wrote a book on that called The Greening of the Revolution. We're seeing that right now in the case of having to quickly find alternative sources of energy. Now, this is not a good thing because nobody should be forced to do it, quote, cold turkey. And it causes a lot of death and destruction in the process. But we're seeing that the Cuban energy system used 6% renewable energy, solar energy, in 2024. And suddenly now that is 20%. They are scrambling to get solar energy. And as part of this convergence on March 21st, the People's Forum in New York has raised hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy solar panels to send to Cuba. But the Chinese have been really helpful in terms of getting solar energy to the Cubans. When you see the transportation, I was in the eastern part of the country. There were hardly any gas cars on the road anymore. But what was there were solar, electric motorcycles and electric, we call them kind of tricycles, but with carriages in the back that can fit six people. So they're an alternative form of transportation and can transport cargo. In fact, going back in time, they also are using horse and carts to do things like pick up garbage. But the electric sources of energy for transportation are really what is saving a lot of Cubans. Unfortunately, just to get a $1,000 electric motorcycle is way out of the reach for ordinary Cubans. So the ones who tend to have those are ones who have relatives in the United States. So it is increasing the inequality, but in any case, it's helping people get around. So we will see a real transformation in Cuba that will help us to learn things for the rest of us about how we can get ourselves finally off of this fossil fuel treadmill.
Appreciate that. Do you see us invading Cuba? The U.S. invading?
I don't think the U.S. wants to invade Cuba because they know, like in the case of Venezuela, that this is a government that is well organized, well armed. I mean, just look at the fact that they were able to detect this boat last week that was entering Cuban waters with armed people wanting to carry out terrorist activities. You know, Cuba has been training for this and stopping attacks since 1959, from the Bay of Pigs to the hundreds of attempts to kill Fidel Castro, to attempts like the boat attempt that we just saw. These fanatical Cuban Americans, violent Cuban Americans, have been trying and sometimes successfully blowing up things in Cuba, just as they've been blowing up things in Miami when they didn't like an organization that wanted dialogue with Cuba. So I don't think the U.S. is going to invade Cuba. The strategy is to strangle Cuba until there are enough people who cry uncle and say, we want to get rid of this government just so we can have some relief. But as I said, that is a form of collective punishment. It's a form of economic warfare. And it's certainly not what the Cuban people deserve.
Medea Benjamin, Code Pink, we appreciate you coming on the show. We will look out for the March 21st solidarity situation, and we will try to have you back so you can alert people as to where they can go, how they can participate, and you know, and be down with the situation. Again, give the website where people can get more information.
It's codepink.org, and there are people coming from the Bay Area, so I'm sure they would love to be on your show and help spread the word.
Definitely. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Colors that you fly, love just one nation, and the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, there is no other choice. God bless the people now. Cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution. And disease, we can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Violence brings one thing, more and more of the same. Military madness, smell of flesh and burning pain. So I sing out to the masses, stand up if you're still sane. All of us gone crazy, I sing this one refrain. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution, to hunger and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. I say power to the peaceful, love to the peaceful young. I say power to the peaceful, love to the peaceful young. We may even find a solution.
With you this afternoon from the subject America's chief moral dilemma. There can be no gainsaying of the fact that America has brought the nation and the world to an awe-inspiring threshold of the future. We have built machines that think and instruments that peer into the unfathomable ranges of interstellar space. We have built gigantic buildings to kiss the skies and gargantuan bridges to span the seas. Through our spaceships, we have carved the highways through the stratosphere. Through our airplanes, we've dwarfed distance and placed time in chains. And through our submarines, we have penetrated oceanic depths. And this is a dazzling picture of our nation's scientific and technological progress. But when we look to the other side, something basic is missing. Our nation suffers from a kind of poverty of the spirit, which stands in glaring contrast to our scientific and technological abundance. Yes, we've learned to fly the air like birds, we've learned to swim the seas like fish. And yet we have not learned the simple art of walking the earth as brothers and sisters. Henry David Thoreau talked once about improved means to an unimproved end. And so often we have allowed the means by which we live to outdistance the ends for which we live. It seems to me that this is expressed nowhere greater than in the continued existence of racism, poverty, and war. The problem is, you see, we have the resources in America to end poverty. The question is whether we have the will. And if we are to end poverty, there must be a tremendous reordering of priorities. Senator Harkey estimated the other day that we spend $500,000 to kill every enemy soldier in Vietnam. And when you look at the other side, it's tragic. We spend only $53 a year for every person that's considered poverty-stricken, and half of that goes for salaries for those who are not poor. The question is, what are we trying to win today? I'm afraid that the administration of our nation is more concerned about winning an unwinnable war in Vietnam than about winning the war against poverty right here at home. Now this leads me to the next evil. It is the evil of war. And nowhere does this evil expressed today more than in the tragic, unjust, evil war in Vietnam. It's tragic that we got in it from the very beginning. As Professor Cominger has said, this tragic war is a product of a gigantic miscalculation that the world after 1945 was and would remain divided into two great blocks, one representing light and the other darkness, and that we who represented the light stood at Armageddon and battle for the Lord. Somehow we moved right on with those miscalculations. This war is the product of a gigantic miscalculation about China and about Asia, probably the largest and most fearful miscalculation in diplomatic history. The notion that Chiang Kai-shek represented the true China, that the communists did not represent China and were not really here to stay and need not therefore be recognized. It was as if Britain and France had gone on recognizing the Confederacy as the legitimate government of the United States 20 years after Appomattox. It is the product of an almost demonic delusion that we were not only called upon to set and keep the rest of the world straight, but that we had the material, intellectual, and moral resources to do this. It is a product of grave miscalculations that because we were a world power, we had power and could use it everywhere in the world. And out of this melancholy body of obsessions and miscalculations have come those notions now so familiar that we, not the United Nations, are the peacekeeping instrument of the modern world. Once accept these assumptions, assumptions almost paranoid in their sweeping vastness, and our war in Vietnam takes on a kind of nightmarish logic. This war has all of the dimensions of a Greek tragedy. And oh, it has done so much damage to our nation. As a result of this war, we have seriously impaired the United Nations. We have forfeited the support of our allies. And so today the United States stands morally and politically isolated in the world. We have greatly strengthened the forces of reaction in our country and excited violence and hatred among our people. We have strengthened the military-industrial complex, which even President Eisenhower once warned us against. And then we have blocked the self-determination of a people. And whether people in our country realize it or not, in large numbers, we are in the tragic position in the war in Vietnam of engaging in a process that perpetuates white colonialism covered up with certain niceties of complexity.
Due to unprecedented civil unrest, all forms of protest are now classified as acts of terrorism. This is not a test. This is not a test.
Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grabber, tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line them up like dominoes. Never bow to a in a toupee, yelling free speech but controlling what the news say. The Lorax called, it's time to find a new shape. RuPaul's never seen a beat that bad on Drag Race. Ain't it obvious the person in the office is a racist? Brad came in the mail, but he opposes immigration. And someone's apple leader, not a foreign armed invasion. That would be the mass man reading graduation ceremonies. Unmarked vans snatching people off the street. Broken Amendments 5, 10, and 14, at least. But please tell me again, oh, this is still democracy?
Repeat, this is not a test.
Coward, traitor. traitor, liar, foe. Grab a tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show. Line him up like dominoes. Coward, traitor, liar, foe. Grab a tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show. Line him up like dominoes. Please explain it to me. The man in charge of the economy's got 6 bankruptcies. Huh? Asking ChatGPT to define GDP, defund an education when half the country can't read. Well, now it's clicking for me. You need the people asleep, and knowledge is the greatest threat to propaganda machines. Remember, books don't burn, they just quietly vanish. So don't wait till it's too late to panic. Iceberg, Titanic, threat level orange. Don't you see that they're ignoring our rights? It's fascism wrapped in red, blue, and white. Coward, traitor, liar, foe. Grab a tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line him up like dominoes. Coward, traitor, liar, foe. Grab a tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line him up like
dominoes.
It's a threat level orange.
Warning.
It's a threat level orange.
Warning.
It's a threat level orange. Threat level orange.
The American dream's like any other. Open your eyes and it's gone.
Hard knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Cam. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else is just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard knock. Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Needin' Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio. Kind of crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on, check out.
Why every novice pick they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they ready from the steel gray beef. Say please. I'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, I lay with a please. Make some shade on your name and speed. Go, hey, Needin' Davey D.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast. Dance out.
Several years ago, my co-author, Stephen Victoria, and I wrote a series of books called Murder, Inc., I-N-C, not I-N-K, Incorporated. And we were writing about American history from below. We were writing in the spirit of the great late historian Howard Zinn, whose people's history of the United States sparked fires in the minds of millions of young people and continues to do so today. We made a point in Murder, Inc. to distinguish imperial history from national history. And we tried to argue that empires are not nations, but imperial structures that own and direct and lead other nations. Therefore, we argue that empires have no allies because the very concept of an empire forecloses the ability to have an ally. It has vassals, only vassals, that it controls, that it directs, that it tells them what to do. Why is that important? Look around you. Look at what happened within weeks in Venezuela. Look at what's happening right now in the United States of America, where armed troops are at war with American citizens and people who want to be citizens one day in America. But again, to the point of no vassals. If a empire interacts with a nation, enters that nation by military force, takes its leader, transports the leader and his wife to another country for a case against that leader in the imperial territory, and then sets up leadership to obey its directives, to give them the raw materials in that nation. Are we talking about two nations, or are we talking about an empire and a vassal state? You answer the question, but be honest about it. Years ago, when we wrote those words, we were thinking of Iraq and Afghanistan, where Americans put in puppets to manage, unsuccessfully, mind you, the successor states to the states that were crushed by military attack because of the resistance of the Iraqi people and the Afghan people. We know now that the most powerful weapons in the world cannot create a result if the people continue to resist. We could not have imagined what we're looking at today. We were more right than we thought we were. We suggest that you take a moment to acquire and then read Murder, Inc. today, and then think about what's happening right now before your very eyes. Were we right? You decide. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll be right back.
KBOO, Portland.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m.